While we're waiting for the presentation to load, I'm Christina Booker, and I'm going to be talking about enhancing linkages to HIV care for positive jail inmates. And the findings that I will be presenting are from the multi-site evaluation. So Dr. Areola first started talking about HIV testing at the 10 sites, or however many are doing the SPINS testing, I think it's 7. And then we heard from 2 of the demonstration sites, and now I'm sort of bringing up the rear with client-level data findings for all 10 sites. In terms of disclosures, I have no personal, financial, or commercial relationships or interests related to this presentation. But while I'm sharing who I am part of the Evaluation Support Center on the APT Associate side, and this presentation was sponsored by HRSA, specifically their HIV/AIDS Bureau, the SPINS group. And I just also want to acknowledge the collaborators, the site staff, the administrators, the PIs, and especially the clients. And to all of you who are in the crowd here from the demonstration sites and the Evaluation Center and HRSA partners. So this is just a quick overview of what I will be presenting. I will talk about some of the data collection methods for the multi-site evaluation. I'll only briefly gloss over the approaches and challenges to linking jail detainees to care because Dr. Williams and Dr. Sheikh did an excellent job of already covering that. And then we'll look at some of the client-level data in terms of client characteristics, then look at some of the linkages to care that could begin in jail and then are continued in the community, and then we'll have some discussion. So first things first, the multi-site evaluation data collection for the client-level data really relies on a baseline instrument that is captured at enrollment, and then a similar subset of these questions are asked again 6 months after the client is released. And then we have a post-release summary where we capture clients' needs and the services that they were linked to within 30 days after their release, and that is something that's actually collected by the staff and not an interview. And then all the while people are getting linkage services, they are recorded on service event records. So if someone is getting some kind of case management or whatever the linkage program is in jail and the community, those are being documented and are an important part of the multi-site. And then we also have access to clinical chart data. Each site partners with the jail to get medical abstractions, if you will, from their partner jails. And then in the community, there is a 6-month chart review with whatever community provider the person is seeing. And I should let you know that the data that I'll be sharing are from 2008 through about mid-October, and the data that I'll be sharing still are preliminary. We have not rolled these data out very far, but we are eager to share them and get feedback and questions. And some of the limitations of this study are that we are asking self-reported behavior, so asking people questions 30 days before their index incarceration. There could be some recall bias or maybe social desirability bias. And given that it's a demonstration, this is not an experimentally designed multi-site study. So very quickly, these are some of the snapshot approaches to linking the jail detainees to care. Some of the things that we heard about earlier are linking people in jail, establishing that relationship before they're released so that once they're released, there's already someone who has a relationship to help someone stay in care and get the services they need. Maybe working with physicians or a healthcare team in jail who would also work with the client when they're in the community. And really the sort of heart of SPINS linkages are using case managers to try to support people in getting their needs met, in this case in jail and in the community. So that's an important piece to emphasize for the multi-site. And at this time, we're also figuring out what are some of the different and reasonable concepts of linkage that make sense for the 10 demonstration sites. So how should we be looking at the linkage piece while people are in jail and then in the community. So that's just part of where we're at as an overall group because the project is ongoing. And again, some of the challenges that were more fleshed out earlier, I don't know that we talked about the challenges of collecting full medical histories while someone is in jail, especially if it is a very short stay, and then some of the space and mobility privacy limitations can present a challenge to program implementation as well. So these are all things that have to be taken into account when providing linkages. So this is the first glimpse, really just process information counts of what data have been collected for the clients in the 10-site demonstration. And these are people who have consented to participate in the multi-site study. So this is not the full number of people who have accepted services because, of course, they don't have to participate in the evaluation. So just very briefly, there are about 933 baseline interviews, and then about half of that number, we have post-release summary data, and then that number is almost split in half again when you look at the six-month follow-up interviews. So in terms of characteristics at enrollment, overall, these are for people who had a baseline interview, predominantly African-American or Black identified. About a quarter of people also identified as Hispanic or Latino. Those questions are separate. And the mean age for people in enhancing linkages was 43, and the range was from young adult to seniors. And by gender, the population in the multi-site is mostly male, and about a third are female. And within the transgender group, it is mostly male to female. In terms of criminal justice experience, the average number of arrests over lifetime reported was 21, but the median was a little lower, 13, and the range of number of arrests over a lifetime were quite wide of a range, and some people who was their first experience and some people who had really a lifetime of jail involvement. And almost half of the people in the multi-site were booked on felony charges, most commonly drug possession, drug sales, also some assault and violence. So next we'll take a look at some of the linkages to care in jail and then 30 days after release. And so the number of people who are represented in the next few slides are 455 people. So this is a first glimpse of what kind of care people are getting while they are in jail. And this is based on the clinical chart data that the jail would allow the evaluators or the staff to abstract information. So over 80% of people had a face-to-face or clinical HIV care appointment. So this would be an appointment specifically to address their HIV needs. Slightly fewer people had a CD4 count that was recorded in their chart. And then a little more than a half of the 455 people were actually on HART while they were in jail. And then there's a big drop in terms of how many people are actually released with a HART supply. And this is largely due to jail policies that may not allow releasees to take medication when they're released. And then in terms of linkages to care in the community within those 30 days after they've been released, again, the first half of the table is for the 455 people. And about half of them attended a first HIV primary care appointment within those 30 days after being released. Almost half also attended a first case management appointment, and a few more than half were still involved with the Enhancing Linkages case management program at 30 days after release. And something to note about this first part of the table is that in some cases, people's appointment had not yet come up, so they might potentially have had some kind of appointment just after the 30 days. So this is really just a window into what's happening 30 days after people leave jail. And then in terms of other needs besides HIV care, as we heard earlier, mental health, psychiatric needs are important for this population, as is substance abuse. So there were approximately 224 people, so half of that 224 had an identified mental health need and actually attended a first appointment, and a little bit higher than that was indicated for substance abuse. So about 346 people had some kind of indication of need for substance abuse treatment, and about 47% of them attended their first appointment within 30 days. And also during that 30-day window, 10% of people had some reincarceration during that period. So now we'll just take a quick glance at some of the preliminary findings for 6 months after release. And this is based on clients who have a baseline and 6-month follow-up data. So homelessness, we heard housing is a really important need for this population. So we looked at the homeless status at enrollment and then 6 months post-release. So the way it's asked on the interview is how many clients consider themselves to be homeless at some point in the 30 days before the baseline or the 30 days before the 6-month follow-up. So at baseline, 38% of people reported being homeless in the 30 days before incarceration. And then at the 6-month follow-up, that number was smaller, 10% lower. Fewer people considered themselves to be homeless in the 30 days before the 6-month interview. And then in terms of some of the care that people are receiving 6 months after release, this is a smaller pool. So this is people who have a baseline and 6-month clinical chart data. So that is actually can be a little more challenging to get because it's sort of farther away from some of the grantees' control. About 75% of the people who had those three forms attended an outpatient healthcare appointment, and a slightly higher number of people had a CD4 count recorded in their chart. And that might seem a little off, but at least one of our sites is doing a separate study with the same population where they're collecting CD4s and viral loads from people. So even if people don't necessarily stay involved with the enhancing linkages or get their health care, they're still getting viral loads and CD4 counts. That's why that number is a little bit higher. And then 63% of this group was on HART 6 months after they left jail. So even though there was that large number of people who did not get HART once they left jail, it seems that there was an increase in number of people who got linked to medications 6 months after jail. And then we also looked at the substance use at baseline and 6 months after release, and it's asked as the number of days in the previous 30 that someone used a whole list of substances, and these were sort of the most striking, but in terms of using alcohol to intoxication, the mean number of days in the previous 30 that people used them at baseline, there was quite a drop for alcohol, heroin, and cocaine, marijuana, not so much. So some of the early lessons learned so far are that the linkage programs in jail settings are demonstrating the feasibility and importance of providing continuity to HIV care for people in jails. And then the community HIV care appointments were slightly better attended than services for mental health or substance abuse, at least in that first 30 days post-release. And then at 6 months, clients were showing some reduced homelessness and substance use when compared to their baseline. And as was stated earlier, this project is ongoing, so data collection is still active. And even though we are disseminating this with the caveat that it's preliminary or still ongoing, there still are some ways that the overall demonstration group is disseminating information, mostly through policy briefs. And also there is a foundational paper that is coming soon, so I'll share that early citation. And then finally, of course, when the findings are final and everything is complete, we'll be disseminating information to stakeholders in corrections, policy, public health. So I just leave you with the website, which is the overall project website, where you can find information about the 10 demonstration sites. And I believe anything that's been disseminated through this project is also available on that homepage. And then there are a couple of references that have come out of this project that might be of interest. So if there are any questions or comments, go ahead. So I can't say by state. I would say, and you might have observations because you work with multiple facilities, but I know some jails don't allow for any of the medication to be released. I think in some cases they may allow people to go back after their release to come pick them up, whatever's remaining in their supply. That is what's coming to mind. And
Dr. So in Chicago, we don't, people who are released aren't released with neither meds nor prescription, but they do get a sticky paper with the name of their medication.
With your project, or in just thinking ahead, would you ever consider making those individuals a priority who are in the facilities that don't get the prescription or the meds to take with them? I mean, as a priority in getting them, I mean, they're all a priority, I mean, each individual, but especially those that don't have the meds, and there could be almost guaranteed lapse in them reaching their meds. Mm-hmm.
I think it's a concern. I think it is something that is a struggle, especially in terms of trying to develop the linkage in the jail and trying to make that be as continuous as possible as people depart, but I don't know that I have.
I have to say, that's a great question. Yeah. I think it gets at the heart of the struggle between public health and jails, because really we need to go in and respect the rules of the house. Like, we don't bring rules, we respect the rules.
Uh-huh.
And so I think the general mm-hmm. approach has been to figure out the workaround. And in many cases, the workaround is to meet somebody at the gate and take them to a medical appointment. So kind of figuring out how we can operate within those rules and still get folks the meds that they need immediately upon release.
But their case manager also is likely to have that information recorded. So, that would be one bridge or workaround to support the access to medications with as little lapse as possible.
Just thinking, if they're linked up with case management, they're going to get their meds once released. So that's kind of the workaround.
And I should add, in Chicago, they're released with sort of a list of their medication, mm-hmm. but they're also given a doctor's appointment. So I guess the idea is that, if women want their meds, you're trying to encourage women
to
go.
Okay, so it's not a complete drop-off.
Right.
Okay, that was my question. Thank you.
That's
very
a good
much.
Question.
There was a question over here. Pink, in the pink, maybe?
It's still inherent disruption in care, because, have you studied it before, or are you studying it to CYP?
So, both. So,
the school doesn't take drop-in, so it can't, you still have to wait, however many days,
right.
off your meds.
So, the appointments that are given from Cook County Jail are to CORE.
In the pink sweater, I think you had a question.
Yes, I have a kind of two-part question. One is if you could talk a little bit about the funding. I'm curious what, with all of your program, what the city and county jails cover versus the SPINS project. And the reason I ask is the jail program we have going right now, the only way that we could get in there to do the testing was to agree to have separate funds to pay for the new positives. If they came
for the care.
Okay. They paid for it through the jail health program, no problem.
Okay, so I think the first question was, what did the city and jails themselves covered as part of this initiative? And I think in some cases, the HIV testing, but that would probably be most true in the sites that already had an established testing program. I know that there was one site that had established opt-out testing, and their expansion or enhancement was to try doing that in another location where it didn't exist. And in that case, I know the State Department of Public Health actually covered the costs of the testing kits. So that was, you know, not the jail's expense. It's a really good question in terms of who is paying for what inside. I know of one case where one of the grantees is supporting an HIV coordinator inside the jail so that they sort of have their marked person inside who really makes things happen.
I think the issue is that it just varies greatly across the 10 sites, across the 18 jails and the 10 sites. But the reality is that because these are demonstration sites and they in general, establish collaborations with their jails prior to funding. Chester knows. So I think they're working with the jails that are more sympathetic to this issue, I guess is what I'm trying to say. So they're not kind of working to get into the jails for which the barriers are greatest. I think that the jails that they're collaborating with are the ones that get it in general, is what I would say. And so this issue of more positives, now there's more care I have to pay for, is probably less of an issue for a demonstration project of this nature. Because I don't want to overstate because Chester has really had a lot of challenges, but in general, that's what I would say.
So it's been primarily them, I understand, paying for treatment and labs and...
Not for care.
For really, right. Mm-hmm. And some for their local evaluation as well.
And they got funding for test kits.
Yes. Like with carryover money, so that was not really part of the initial piece. I think what's interesting is that because the testing that already exists in your jails was not guaranteed 100% available, SPINS did actually support some testing to enhance that in sites where the jails were not conducting very much HIV testing.
Mm-hmm. To return to the issue of interruptions in therapy by not inmates not leaving the medications, to the extent that interruptions can lead to drug resistance. It can result in some harm. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if this is, and I certainly understand the issue of working within their policies, and I understand it must be a big challenge. But I wonder if a study like this is an opportunity to document the potential harm from those policies, specifically as viral load being checked before and after release, because you know people. Their options for therapy can be limited forever if they suffer resistance as a result of these. So I know that's probably not the mission of this study at all. But is there an obligation to say, the jail doesn't even give you a prescription? I understand in the case management they do, but not everybody gets case management services. So that as a provider, that really struck me. Mm-hmm. I don't want to. I'm not casting any blame, but just saying is there an opportunity to try to improve policies that we know would avert some of this potential danger?
I think that's a great point, and like I said, this is the tiniest tip of the iceberg of analysis, so these ideas and these questions about the potential implications of beginning care and then continuing it, I think are important. The jail policy, I don't know what's feasible or reasonable to expect.
I was just going to say, I think that's the foundation for the entire demonstration project. Because so if these 10 projects never existed, once people are released, you know, kind of all hell breaks loose from a medical perspective. It's with these programs that get linked to care within a week. So I think that the argument that based on the work that they're doing actually is for the development of stronger policies to improve access to medications, but it's really their work that I think is arguing for that. I mean, you could argue, well, maybe even closer, like, you know, we need even stronger policies, but I think in many ways the grantees through this demonstration project are kind of crawling before they're walking.
Is there anyone here who's done that successfully, used data to convince or change policies that we should know about?
That's a good point. That's a great point.
So we have some work to do. Larry?
Just along the same line, having to recall here, I hope I'm recalling correctly, but there is research, I think on the jail in San Francisco, that looked at prescription filling. And even though they got prescriptions, the filling of prescriptions, the first prescription was fairly dismal. And the second prescription was really dismal. And there was a lot of people that there was a 2-week gap, or at least a 2-week gap, which is, I think, considered a critical time period. So even though it's probably a good thing, it's not a panacea.
Absolutely. And it's worth just saying that that's Dr. Larry Ouellette from the UIC site as well. So, and then there was a question over here. Yeah.
I can see that around 50% used case management services or attended their first case appointment, and only 50% attended their first doctor appointment. As far as troubleshooting what keeps people from attending that first appointment, has there been any indication that the fragmentation of services is a problem, meaning people have trouble with transportation, let's say, or wanting to afford transportation to go to all of these different appointments, and that a possible solution would be having a place, and some of them already exist, where all of these are housed under one roof. Is there any indication that that would be a benefit to increasing the number of people who are in these first
That is a great question, and I don't know that I can think of any examples that are like that. I think the most sort of integrated component that comes to my mind is having that same healthcare provider be the one that sees someone in jail and then potentially see them afterwards. And it might be interesting for us to look at the different models and is there any difference in attendance of the first primary care appointment. You know, based on how integrated or how known the provider might be. Did you have any comments?
In a lot of cases, care and case management can be found sort of under the same roof, but if someone needs, say, you know, substance abuse treatment or, you know, other types of services, those are going to be in other locations. And transportation is, I mean, it is one of the biggest issues.
But that's why the purpose of case management is to deal with that. Exactly. So in situations where you can't have everything housed under one roof, it's your case management services that get people to the places they need to be.
Actually, I have a question for Dr. Shea, because I don't know if you're planning to go back.
This is a good time, actually, to just transition to.